Too kind, thank you. So, good evening. This is my name's Odo Quay, and I'm going to be doing a general talk about my experiences in regards to work and being on the spectrum and a lot of other things as well that I would like to add. Not my first time doing this, as Sarah's mentioned before, which I would say explains the next slide, which this image was, I know for some people, maybe a bit of a surprise considering they were employers, but the point of it was my way of saying, considering my experiences with the services and some of the workers there, I don't exactly trust them. So this is how I'm going into it, and I wanted to be very clear exactly what I wanted to say. And the quote in question is from Native American activist Ward Churchill, because often these sort of things get brought up as like speaking truth to power. But I think my issue with that is power already knows what the issue is at hand. So it's about speaking the truth to people in the teeth of power who are already going through it, which I felt was much more applicable than that. This is just my experiences, and this does go to some very hairy territory in terms of subjects I bring up. So if you feel this is a bit much, I understand. So starting off explaining what autism is, it's basically a different way of looking at the world, in all honesty. And but that different way of thinking comes with certain noticeable signs and traits that some people will find kind of neurotypical people will find kind of grating or difficult to deal with. And some of those details include like having obsessive interests, being fairly intense, stimming, which is like doing repetitive movements with your hands in order to kind of relax or help focus, and difficulty in dealing with change, which, oh boy, let me tell you, that's something I can talk about very, very well. It's not a fixed thing. It generally works on a wide spectrum. Everybody's on it. But some people have the signs of it that's more, you know, it's more obvious for them more so than others. And this was interesting for me because I think about when I got diagnosed when I was about 17, when after I got the meeting with the specialist, when me and my mother both had a look at the email, which had all the select signs in there, and we both took a look at each other and was like, yeah, you've got it. But it wasn't just that I got it. She was able to trace it back to my great grandmother back in Jamaica, who couldn't read and write, but her mental arithmetic was really strong. You can tell me if I'm wrong about that. Okay. This was also compounded by the fact that my nan, when she came over, she told me that she didn't know how to read, so she taught herself how to do it. And also I got let known that some years back, that when she was younger, some relationship that she had with somebody didn't go as well or as planned, so she had a breakdown because of it, which for me was a sort of a validating thing in terms of, right then. So it's not just as if it's all buzzing around in my head. There's actually a precedent for this. That's worthwhile to know. There's other co-occurring conditions as well, which is also usually like ADHD or dyslexia and dyspraxia, which my old man has dyslexia, I mean, so it all makes sense and all kind of comes together. It's not just one thing, it's many. And each variation of the condition, it differs from person to person. What you got, some people like me who can be like very long-winded and eloquent in talking. You get some people who don't talk at all and find communication better in terms of using like cards or using like maybe speech synthesis or anything like that. And technology generally plays a massive part in this. So the two people you're probably wondering there is, top fella is Hans Asperger, and the bottom is Bruno Bettelheim, who were both experts on the subject. Well, Bettelheim, it's more debatable, because he was a Freudian psychologist who was a director at the University of Chicago, and based his theory on the idea of refrigerator mothers, meaning mothers who didn't give like empathy or care to their kids, and that's how they developed emotionally. And Asperger's study was based around him studying the behaviors and patterns of four boys who he had in his particular, you know, experiments and the like. He did this across like 200 kids, and he noticed about their absorption of interest, clumsy movements, etc., etc. Now, the thing that links these two men together is the Nazis. The latter, because he was in Dachau and Buchenwald for 10 months, and he managed to flee, but he used his experiences of being around Nazi guards to explain his theories and thinking, and he made up his credentials at most taking free introductory courses, whereas Asperger, there's still a debate on whether his experiments were done with the Nazi party having the knowledge of it or not, or he tried to shield them. People have been undefined all as of now, and that's why they prefer to use autism or being on the autistic spectrum rather than his name. So it's complicated, but I think it's worth bringing up because a lot of the sort of subtext regarding these two and some of the issues with them that you can apply definitely to the discussion regarding this and regarding this subject. So in terms of me, how it affects me in sort of like a day-to-day sort of thing, well, sense of direction's always been bad, especially when it comes to trying to find new destinations. There's been more than one time where I've had to turn and go back because I've lost my way there. Short-term memory, never been the best, especially when it comes to sort of putting objects down where I can remember them. And especially considering how my health's been for the last year and some change, it's been even more so. Time management has been always an issue in terms of deciding when is the right time to leave and go to a place, or when to focus on one task and move to a next. I didn't get extra time until like second year of sixth form, and that was kind of to do with retakes. So you can imagine in secondary school trying to do essays, especially when I was feeling like I was starting to get a hang of them, it was equal parts trying to drill my way through all the information while trying to make sure it made sense, which not making sense is definitely factors into communication skills, where being so knowledgeable of things, it's not that a lot of the time people have been wondering what the hell are you talking about, which leads to that fun factor of making friends with people who are generally older than you more often than not. And the other thing as far as talking about being on the spectrum as well is, for me, part of the reason it didn't happen until late was because my issues were pinned down to hard work and me not applying myself, which I would say as of now, when I think about it, I do kind of have an issue in where I tend to feel like I'm not doing enough or trying to find ways to occupy that time, which is a hell of a problem when you're dealing with ADHD, because you take in the information that you know you need to be doing something and you want to do something, but it's how you carry that out, how you put that information into practical use is the problem. So it can end up with you just lying in your bed, staring at the ceiling, wondering, what do I do next? It's not that I can't do anything, it's just that sometimes you need a bit of a guiding hand to kind of nudge you in the right direction. And frustration, being on edge, especially when you've got big events like, say, exams or interviews or anything, that's definitely some of the things that have come into fruition. Now, slow erosion here. This is where it comes to work and everything. Top right image, the very hazy blue one, in case you're wondering where that's from. That's from the 1998 movie Belly, directed by Hype Williams, with Nas and DMX in the car, which I think maybe, I don't know if I'm the first person to bring Belly up in this context, but whatever. And Nas was trying to school DMX on this book that he was reading, and DMX was telling him, you know what, forget a book, man, that's not our purpose, we're here to make money. What you should be focusing on is you should be focusing on making money for your seed, because as he says, shorty can't eat no books, which is a sentiment for people who don't really take education too seriously. And I picked this image because that was kind of my mentality. That was my thinking after a while doing volunteering and going to various places and dealing with experts, especially where it kind of turned me into like your stereotypical TV sitcom uncle who's like, you're better off learning to become, figuring out how to become an electrician or something like that. So in a certain way, I was like, yeah, I guess shorty can't eat no books. There's also the fact of promises not being kept, and also suggestions as far as, you know, a lack of empathy in terms of what I'm dealing with, which I think comes from the fact that, well, you can see how I look, broad-shouldered, I speak well enough, blacks as well. So sometimes when I try to express things, the response is like, well, what are you complaining about? You don't look like you have anything going on with you. And that's not the first time that's happened. There's a very distinctive moment I remember trying to deal with my dissertation where a GP said something along those lines. And I'm certain that if my nan wasn't there with me, I probably wouldn't have gotten that extension. The exhaustion really wears you down, considering the amount of effort that factors into with the kind of work they're in. And it doesn't just take a toll on you in the physical sense where you're completely dead tired and you struggle to move. Mentally, your thoughts are completely just shot. It's like you're in a blank space. I can remember I used to work at a certain football stadium not far from here. And if they factored in that I was on the spectrum, it didn't come off that way. Considering I was on my feet all day, considering that I was dealing with supporters who would get mad and maybe take it out on you if their team was losing. The constant feeling of staff kind of breathing down your neck to make sure you weren't taking nothing from the tills. And also just when I was there, because it's been since been rebuilt, some of the equipment that we had in our space wasn't up to date. On the ground floor, you had people using touch screens and you're still using the old chock-a-block white tills where you have to remember how much things cost and input it in yourself. And I didn't enjoy that, but I was there for 2 years. And I don't want to go back to that. Trust me. And the last image there in the bottom right, if you can tell where it is, that's from Mad Max 1, from the conclusion where he leaves the guy with the choice of he can either hack his foot off with a hacksaw to get out of there, or he can just stay there and be blown up by a petrol bomb. And I picked that because it felt like at certain times, maybe if I had something that was very visible for them to notice, they would take my concern seriously. Bit of an extreme example, I know, but when so much of the talk comes back to this idea of, is it me? Am I the problem? Your mind starts going down to some very, very interesting and disturbing places as far as how to try and get somewhere and get what you need in terms of support. So yeah, what worked for me and what didn't in a myriad of ways. In terms of employment, I also wrote for a website for 6 months, which was pre-COVID, mind you, when I did that at home. So it was nice to have a space to my own. And it was also nice to have a supportive team where everybody was talking about what they were doing, kind of bossing jokes and getting to discuss, talk about different topics back and forth. But at the same time, when you're doing it on your own, you're very much that. And in terms of, as much as I dislike the term content writing, they do demand of a certain level of output from you. And for me, that was kind of too much to deal with at certain points. And I was never very good at like conversation in the previous job I was at. They wanted somebody who was more like a bantery person, where for me, my focus, and I thought I was being perfectly sound in my reasoning. It was, I'm going there to do the job. I know I don't like it here, but I'll come there, do it, and then leave. I'll talk with people if need be, and if things need to be done, but otherwise, that's where my head is at. But somehow it seemed like that was kind of a problem sometimes, including a supervisor I remember nicknaming me Smiler at one point, which I think you can imagine where that was coming from. The other issue is in terms of like the feedback and the output not matching up to what I was putting in. So at the end of an exceptionally exhausting day, you get a pay slip, and that pay slip says you made 32 quid that day. Even though it was only weekends, there was one time I did it in the week, it just felt like, this is it. I'm sort of supposed to be satisfied with this. It's not really enough for me there. And the image in the middle kind of sums up a lot of my experience with this, is it feels like I've been battering my head against the wall in the hope that at a certain point I will be able to get past it. But all it's really left me with is a heavy amount of headache and a lot of frustration and a lot of anger and me going in repeated thought patterns over and over. And yeah, this is still kind of an ongoing issue in terms of my search, trying to look for work in that regard and just trying to integrate myself with a particular niche and people that I could call my own, which has made my social life kind of a rough one as well. So, recent life updates as far as these. One full year with long COVID from September of last year until this year has made things that much harder in terms of in a physical sense of getting around, but also in terms of my breathing, in terms of my thinking, in terms of my ability to focus. It's a real serious challenge, and especially with you unfortunately can't rely on the internet because there's a lot of mixed messages, and the general consensus that a lot of people have, they think it's just something that you have to work at in order to get better. And that's not exactly the case, because if you push yourself too hard, you can fatigue yourself. You're meant to take this rather slowly. But of course, the pace you're supposed to go at in dealing with this is not entirely the pace that some people would like you to go at. They want you to go at things a bit more brisk, is what I'm saying. And I should have taken off that previous PowerPoint about whatever illness, but if anything, it being there is kind of poignant, because for the longest time, I didn't know what I was sick with. And that includes 2 hospital visits and multiple visits to my GP, which isn't helped by the fact that I don't have a consistent one. And if you want to get an appointment, you have to try and book it first thing in the morning, because otherwise you're going to have to deal with a very long line of people. finally managed to get Pip after not getting that twice, which was a challenge because the forms itself are worded very strangely, especially in my case as somebody who's an English Lit creative writing grad, where the words in there, you'll come across something and it doesn't seem as simple as it looks. They'll have like four or five different ways you can interpret it. And this is done on purpose. There's also the fact that sometimes the distance to actually get to these places can be a challenge in terms of assessments. And literally it comes down to whoever you have, whether they decide if you're going to get it or not. And in my case, because I speak well enough or eloquent enough, again, they could take it and see it as, oh, if you're able to speak as well as you can, then that's, you should be managing okay. You're not too bad. Which also extends to some people when they've learned that they've got a graduate in their midst, forgetting, hey, I'm not here just for that. I'm here to try and find work. And as well as that, yeah, this year was also a harrowing one because four women I knew in various ways who were quite important to me died this year. Or really, one of them did in April when I was making progress, and that brought a lot of my symptoms back. And the other three I learned after the fact. One of them I knew from sixth form, one of them I knew online. The other was somebody who I used to work at my old secondary, and then I came back in contact with them through the Haringey services, and it was August. I didn't learn that they had passed until when I went to the local hub area where a bunch of us got to, and I learned then and there on the day that she had passed back in August, which is a lot to deal with. A lot to deal with in that regard. And all in all, when you combine this, especially with Pip, it's left me like that gentleman in the bottom right image. Pip is the personal independence payment, which is meant to assist people who have disabilities in terms of being able to pay for things, like in terms of services they can access, in terms of specialist equipment, or just day-to-day sort of living things. And they are notorious for being exceptionally hard to get. And I remember I explained this to some people when I last got my hair shaped up in the barbers. My hair hasn't been brushed, so allow me. And when I explained this to them, they were quite... I don't think anybody had told them about this process because they never had to think about it. And when I told them it depended on the day, it was two guys who got into this big dark discussion with. He was like, so wait a minute, you mean to tell me if you go to if you got like five different independent diagnoses and you go there, it literally depends on the person you're there with? And I told him, brethren, I went with two. And that's not even, I really regret not even factoring him with him as well, how difficult it can be in the first place to even try to get a diagnosis. I only was able to get mine done because I was going sixth form in Walthamstow. Otherwise, my GP wasn't having any of it. Who would want it was the question he asked me and my mother when we first tried to request it. True story. So, as well as these things, so this is a big issue I have as far as the talking point, which will link in with my next slide, is so much of the talking points regarding trying to get around and deal with things on the spectrum, it tends to come back onto what are you doing to change it? How are you doing it to change your situation? You need to adjust so that way other people don't feel deterred off or feel worried about trying to deal with you. You know, smile more, try and make your voice sound more upbeat on the phone. Say the questions that sometimes if I've maybe slipped up or made mistakes in the house where I get asked, say you get a job and you have this particular task at which you need to do and you don't do that properly, how do you think that's going to pan out? Or I specifically remember in one instance in the car in the summer, I think this must have been 2014, where I was especially frustrated, and this is what sooner or later led me to having a breakdown, being told, for God's sake, when you're looking for a job, don't look like you're trying to look like you're looking for one. And I got really pissed off in that car that time. So, because I didn't know, how the hell do I do that? I've had people tell me, try and look interested, and I've just asked them, how do I look interested? How do I do that without looking like I'm desperate or needy? And they're completely flummoxed at that. And it's really made me grow to loathe the word responsibility, because it's people using that something that's meant to be kind of freeing as a cudgel, where they make it as though this is the only way you're meant to go about things. This is the particular way you're supposed to go around in the world. And at a certain point for me, it makes me just wonder, when I'm trying to juggle so many different things, how much more can I show that I'm trying to take responsibility? And I'm at this point now where I just really don't want to hear it anymore. And so much of this is bent on this focus of like having to prove that you need this assistance. It's very sort of vindicationist, which can be, I find, very, very demeaning after a while. And I say this with all due respect to everybody that's come on, as far as talking about vindication, trying to show something that is unequivocal, that can't be argued against. I say this as somebody who is the producer and co-host of a podcast, which is very much about showing people that there's more to people on the spectrum than just the general conceptions or feeling like they're suffering, or this other idea that is, if, oh, you can just manage for everything, you're like a neurotypical person, but with these extra bits that need dealing with. Now, the bottom image, I suppose you're wondering, that's from the stories of Baron Munchausen. And it's arguably the origin of where the expression pull yourself up by your bootstraps comes from. If you look at like newspaper reports and stuff from 1910, there's people who bring it up, but they don't use it in the way that people associate with it now. They were being sarcastic. It meant to be, this is somebody trying to do the impossible. If you got a pair of boots, or you got a pair of trainers, and you notice the little flaps at the back where the heel's meant to be, those are your bootstraps. Have a go trying to pick yourself up by those and come talk to me later. And this also factors in terms of a lack of consistency, which is something I've dealt with for damn near most of my life, in terms of like teachers and staff. And some of it sounds ridiculous to even bring up now, but because it's been consistent, and this usually I've only tend to learn about them going after the fact. In one case, is my Job Centre Plus disability work advisor died. It's very, very jarring, and it rubs you to the point of being very, very raw. That lack of consistency is the consistency in its own right. And dealing with that change, especially when it's abrupt, can be hard to grapple with. In a lot of cases for me, it's been like, you just kind of take it on board and try to get yourself through it, but you pay with it in the long run. And it causes me to be one of those people who kind of frets over things that I don't really have much control or say over, because those feel like the most immediate things, whereas other things that are probably right in front of me kind of feel ancillary. I bring up the logo of the Autism Show with no disrespect, because I think back to the time when I assisted there, and it was my first time. I had to go there early, And I did, because needing assistance opening with tables and putting up posters and things of that nature. And when I got there and I looked around and I saw there was people selling weighted blankets, there was like schools or groups where you could go outside of London and they were geared towards people on the spectrum that they could assist with, and like studies and experiments that you could take part in, because I like experiments. I've always liked science and stuff, science. And so at that point, I must have been 26, 27, and I was already past the point of when I could really, you know, apply for these things, or if I was to apply for them at that point, it would be in sort of a adjusted scenario of like, right, you're not the exact age range for this, but we can give you something close to that. And that was a real, like, horrible bottoming out feeling, being there and seeing all this, because a lot of these things I didn't learn until years later, which would have been very, very beneficial, especially in the early years when I'm trying to still grapple with it. Because in a lot of ways, my diagnosis was like, here it is, you figure it out. And I'm still very much trying to figure it out, even now before I turn at 29, you know? So, yeah. In case you're wondering where the title comes from, it comes from jazz bassist Charles Mingus, who had a very foul temper and was arguably a manic depressive. There's a famous documentary footage of when he's being evicted from his flat where he picks out a rifle and shoots it in the ceiling, which I recommend that you all watch if you get the opportunity to. And that quote stems from when one night he was doing a performance and the crowd wasn't paying attention and they were clinking their glasses, disturbing his focus. And he said that and was like, I'm done, I'm leaving, which him and his band did. So for me, it is the case of, it is a matter of perspective, because oftentimes it's coming from, they don't tend to consult the persons in terms of what they think. It's this weird thing where if you're somebody who slips through the cracks like me, you know, they define you as like, you can self-actualize, which is kind of covert, is like the underhanded way of saying you can manage on your own, you don't need any help. And then on the other side, for people who maybe can't communicate or have trouble in a physical sense, they deem that as, we make all the decisions for you and not let you make any kind of decision making. And there's a double standard, because sometimes there's people who I have to do more work than them, when it should be the other way around. There should be adjustments. You know, there's this saying that people sometimes take as a truism, that you have to work twice as hard for half as much. And there is a certain level of a factual basis on that. But the problem is, again, it comes back to you. And if you're somebody like me who's on the spectrum, let's be real, you're working three times as hard, four times as hard, sometimes maybe five times as hard as somebody. And it's, if you want me to be really blunt with it, that's not fair. That's really tiring. The idea that you're supposed to just push through things and then you'll be done with it, you will feel the repercussions of that in the long run. You know, it's always, that's because of that. That's why I have a disordered relationship with overworking myself. I'm trying not to do that, but you keep getting, you know, if you just do that much more, then maybe you know, that will assist you in getting to where you need to be. And there was a certain point in my life where everything I did was either meant to directly or indirectly gear me towards getting into work. And especially at a certain point when the referendum happened back in 2016, the best way I can describe that was that it felt like an earthquake had happened and buildings were collapsing all around me. And I remember the morning, that Friday morning after the results, thinking, I need to try and get myself into something now. Because if I don't, who knows what's not going to be there and what's going to change. And I tried to change up my approach. I tried to do all of that. And things didn't pan out like that. I use imagination because it's like that blueprint there. It's supposed to be like the guideline, you know, the guidelines or the parts that are supposed to, you know, help you picture what the future is like. And while the encouragement of being positive and looking towards the future does, you know, on the surface, it seems practical advice and is good for you, it does have this unfortunate thing where at the same time, if you're trying to be realistic and trying to being selective in your judgment, it makes you one, you know, it kind of puts you in a cycle where you think back on past mistakes and past events that didn't pan out as you would have hoped. And there's also the dichotomy where if you try to be positive, then there's people who tell you, you know, you need to bring it down a little. You're not being realistic. You try and be realistic, people and say, oh, you're being a bit too pessimistic. You need to lighten up a little bit. So it's like, which is it? What am I supposed to be? Which area am I supposed to be? And the mixed messages can often do more harm than good and just make me want to throw my hands up and be like, I'm just going to leave it. I don't know how I'm supposed to see the world or whatever. Let me just make up my mind on the matter. Now, this is the part where I have a lot to say on this matter. There's certain people out there who would probably say this is like a typical loony leftist North Londoner thing. But the fact of the matter is, I live in Wood Green. I don't live in Crouch End. And I bring this up because I remember during lockdown when the pandemic was happening, when I saw how many people on Good Morning Britain was living on Islington, it was like, oh, so that explains why people keep on saying, bringing that about metropolitan elitists from North London. They're thinking of Crouch End, Muswell Hill, Highbury and those areas. They're not thinking of the North London I'm familiar with, which is Wood Green, Tottenham, Enfield, Edmonton, those sort of sides, which is where I'm coming at it from. And I'd like to think as well, as somebody of a Jamaican Ghanaian background, I've got a very wide berth in terms of what I can bring up and what I can address. And so much of this for me, rather than it being one particular issue, it tends to come back to structures. Structures in terms of how, you know, waiting for things to be done, structures in terms of like lines, structures in terms of the, you know, the various facilities and places that I'm supposed to go to. And if they don't work, I try and find something else. And those people end up directing me back to places I've been before. But also, like, how many, in terms of people who've talked about their experiences in a general sense, no offense to Chris Packard and the rest of them, but it's often been white people who I've seen. I tried to look up people, black people on the spectrum, and the only two who I've really been able to find are Jason Ardy, who's professor of sociology at Cambridge and youngest person appointed to a professorship, and Tyler Grant off of Hollyoaks, which also in their case is interesting because they're a trans individual. And you often have to deal with a broad stereotype, you know, broad comments from people who otherwise don't know. And I know there's a history in terms of like black people, in terms of contention and skepticism with the medical industry. But the problem with that is, say like with flu jabs, with like Andrew Wakefield saying they're the cause of autism and people being very adamant that they're not going to take it, I don't think they realize what those sort of comments are kind of saying to people like me, as though you made the idiot decision to go and do this and it's your fault. And this also links to black conservatism, which is an ideology that is founded on pessimism and focused on survival and personal responsibility, which is a comment that I've heard from some people in terms of saying black people need to take more responsibility when we've been doing so for flipping generations, as far as I'm concerned. And I get where it comes from, but as somebody on the spectrum, black conservatism doesn't have anything to offer me, or what it is offering isn't enough. It's just saying, work hard, get your act together, and then you'll have everything you need. And that's not true. That's not true. And if you were to listen to certain people, some of them to, sorry, skip ahead, but certain individuals like these, you'd get the impression that black people or ethnic people with disabilities don't exist. And considering the guy in the top right hand, top left corner, he probably wouldn't like me bringing him up in a discussion regarding race, but you're a public individual, so you're going to get this. This is Britain's first black chancellor, former chancellor who only lasted 38 days. Like my old man, Ghanaian, but he's of a different tribe, Kwasi Kwarteng. And I bring up my old man in comparison because his parents emigrated here. My old man had to flee the country to get here because of a military coup. He told me so himself. He never went Eton like this gent, like he did. And I bring up Eton and I bring up Harvard and everything because so much of the focus in terms of education is on accomplishment or underachievement. And that gave him this sort of veneer of authenticity, which bothers me because him and Sunak, who's our prime minister, and former equalities minister and now minister of business and trade, Kemi Badenoch, have all waded in one way or another, trying to position themselves as both sort of the objective ethnic voice, you know, diverting themselves from the hegemonic thought, when at the same time they're trying to cool the feelings of like the majority of the Tory base who are like white people. Not saying that there aren't ethnic members in there, but they don't make up a sizable amount of it. And it shouldn't, like, people said that with Liz Truss's cabinet, this was some sort of threshold crossing, and it wasn't, because often these people are some of the most right-wing members of the Conservative Party. And I'm sorry to say it, but I have to quote the late, great John Henrik Clark. I don't understand how there can be black conservatives. What are you trying to conserve? On top of that, I would also ask, who are you conserving for and why? And I take issue with these people because so much of their talking points is on behaviors or mind states or mentalities. And let's be honest here, they're all just ways of talking about race without directly saying it. Because we're in a time and place where, you know, bringing up eugenics is totally frowned upon. Although there is a history of certain black leaders, Booker T. Washington, whose image was in the previous slide, was friends with Charles Davenport. W.E.B. Du Bois, of all people, was saying how, like, was comparing black people to vegetables, saying how they're too caught up on the quantity of children they have rather than the quality of them, because he was one of the black middle class saying that people should have less kids but with better genes. And this factors in, of course, to his philosophy of a talented tenth. And it just eliminates all nuance on the discussion. I picked Booker T in the previous image because people like to bring up Garvey and Malcolm X, but they don't realize a lot of the ideas in terms of like black business and entrepreneurship, which, believe me, in terms of that's often a thing. Self-employment is brought up for people with disabilities as like, this is how you get around it. And I have nothing against people going into that, but I hate it when they bring it up like as if it's a simple thing. And it's not. There's so many things that go into that. And I wanted to bring this up because I don't entirely feel proud as somebody who worked his ass off and still didn't really get anywhere. Non-viability is a very real thing. Black excellence is just as much of a trap as it is defining people as being like thugs or drillers or shotters. Because, and I get where that comes from, because mediocrity in the past was seen as like being incompetent by standards of judging it, which has also led to kind of this exhaustive sort of boosterism as far as, you know, supporting our own and pushing the best and brightest of it and whatever, not allowing people to be themselves, which is kind of what I'm asking for, is to allow me to be me, you know? The image there of the bottom is Sabin from Final Fantasy VI, who rejected being the Prince of the Throne through a coin toss with his older brother after the king died and felt like the people in the kingdom didn't give a crap. And I bring that up because, what do you know, on my old man's side of the family, I'm supposed to be royalty. But that's something I feel like people have made more of a big deal of than myself. There's never really been much of an opportunity, and I've never felt a reason to gloat over it. I grew up listening to conscious rappers who brought up how people are supposed to be all descended from kings and queens and whatever. And I'm like, that's funny, because I'm somebody who's of that, and I ain't seen none of this. I ain't seen none of this in my own personal experience, even in speaking to my own relatives. And when I try to tell people this sometimes, or they think I've got money, they think I'm taking the piss, or they don't believe me. And it's very, very frustrating. So it's a thing that's made me very self-aware, hyper self-aware of my place in the world. And in some ways, it's why I've had to kind of define myself by my own canon and who I see myself as well, which, in terms of that, leads me to looking at people like the gentleman on the top, George Schuyler, who's part of my own canon of stubborn bastards who march to their own rhythm rather than following anybody else. He wrote one of my favorite books of all time, Black No More, which involves a scientist who makes a machine that is able to turn black people white, and that screws up so many race leaders' money because they was using that as a way to get the bag. Very hilarious, very scathing. A lot of people get caught up in the crossfire, including Marcus Garvey. I chose that because that's not him in the stride, in his usual strident images that people associate with. And I bring him up because he was always more of a symbol than a person for me growing up, until I learned that he had asthma and he was prone to getting sick, which was like, oh, so you weren't always Mr. Stoic all the time. You had your own foibles then. That's great. And then I also learned he made some very fascinating comments, like he's saying how one of the UNIA's aims was to Christianize the backward savages of Africa, which I didn't know about that growing up. None of the Rastaman them ever said anything about that. And he was somebody who saw it through European lenses. He even at one point, and I'm sorry to bring this up, he even, as is infamously known, he had a sit-down meeting with the head of the Atlanta KKK, saying that he thanked the Klan for, I quote, lynching race consciousness into black people in America, which when I read that, I was like, pardon? And you're supposed to be the guy who is Mr. Up Ye Mighty Race, emancipate yourself from mental slavery and all that. Yeah, sure. Okay. It's good to... Yeah, sure. Pardon me with that. But there's a difference. We need more nuance with things. And I realized I don't have to be so head-on and direct with everything. There's a strength that comes with doing things on your own. But at the same time, I would like to share more things with people, because I do enjoy doing that. And I think it would be beneficial. And to sort of tie this up, these are various things that I did learn about this. And it's been a decade, and I don't want it to be a thing where other people go through, because no way do I believe that they should have done as much work, and I don't think I should have done so. And there's a limit to raising awareness, because that's just it. You're making people aware, but it's not doing anything on top of that. it relates, this is my story and it relates to me, but there's other people who've gone through similar things. And it all interlinks, and it's important to bring up that these all interlink in one way or another. And a lot of this has been me trying to understand what it is that I want. Now, I just wanted to make sure I got onto this last slide, because these are some of the things that I think people could, you know, employers and people and staff in general could help. Partially, and honestly, my opinion would be to like uproot the whole thing and start over. But it's not just me who needs support. It's the people working in these industries who need support, because cuts always hit them first and the hardest. And they often get exhausted because of all the different considerations here. And yes, I did pick this image on purpose, because one of the issues I have with black conservatism is it can be counterintuitive in terms of things that are available to me, because they see it as you taking handouts and you're not doing it properly on your own. These are the sort of figures who people like to point to as examples of saying they did it by themselves without handouts. They all did. All of them did. Musk might try and argue now and say that his father didn't own a diamond mine in any case, but he did. He did. And Jeff Bezos did get $300,000 from his mother. How many people do you know whose parents have that sort of disposable income where they could do that to fund a possible business venture that may or may not be a success? Ask me, anybody who has the chance, ask me about my feelings regarding Swiss and Black Pound Day, because I've got a lecture in VAT on its own. But this has been my presentation on being black and unemployed. And also, before we finish, the reason I chose Cast Down Your Buckets is because that was Booker T's sort of metaphor as far as like trying to, you know, do things on your own. And as far as I'm concerned, I have been casting down my buckets. Everything I've been doing in terms of reaching out to people and trying to get assistance is me trying to advocate for myself and taking responsibility for that. These things are mine. I want it. I want the assistance so that way I can function better in my own right, and I'm not going to take no quarter for it. I don't want any half measures or pickings because I'm older than people. I want what I'm owed, and I've been owed from God knows how long, from when I was like 7 or 8 or even earlier. And that's it. Hope you all enjoyed that, and thank you for tuning in and listening.
Well, thanks very much for that, Odo. Mm-hmm. I think that was fully justified in us giving you an extra 20 minutes, and you clearly would have gone on longer. So
yes.
We will definitely have to ask you to speak for us again.
No problem.
We will prepare one of these recordings. We've had 4, and 2 have failed. So we'll see what footage we come out with at the end, and we'll put up the result on our YouTube channel and advertise on artisticempire.com.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for watching.
Yeah, thank you all.